Welcome to the Medicare Made Simple podcast. John Fox is an advisor who helps seniors understand their Medicare options and make the right choices for their needs. To learn more about your Medicare options, simply visit us at www.wespeakmedicarespokane.com. On the podcast, John brings together thought leaders in senior care to share with you how they help seniors make the best decisions during life transitions. And now, here's your host, John Fox.
And we will get started. So, this afternoon, I am sitting here with Holland McBurns. She's the managing partner of Evergreen Elder Law. And rather than me explain what they specialize in, Holland, thank you for joining me today. Please explain to me what your firm does, and then I'd like to know what brought you to this point. What was the impetus for you to specialize in elder care?
Great. Well, thanks for having me, John. I appreciate it. So my firm, Evergreen Elder Law, we emphasize elder law and estate planning. And of course, estate planning is not just for seniors. It's for all age groups, particularly if you have minor children, for the younger families, but definitely for people reaching the age of retirement as well, and getting ready to get all their paperwork together. The elder law piece is comprised of guardianships and long-term care planning, as well as probate and estate administration. A guardianship is the process whereby if you fail to have a properly drafted or fail to have any power of attorney in place, the guardianship is the process whereby a judge in Superior Court will determine who will have the authority to make your medical and financial decisions. And it can be a lengthy and expensive process, so I always encourage everyone of any age to have a well-drafted power of attorney in place to avoid having to have a guardianship.
So as we're doing this, do you mind if I interject and ask questions?
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay. So this is exactly what spurred me to add these extra chapters is I recognize as I'm dealing with folks how most of their challenges are a result of waiting too long to do the planning that should be done. And so they end up in the situation where the family is in crisis mode and having to make decisions that maybe the individual did not address when they could address them. And so as I'm listening to this, the guardianship is kind of like a crisis mode decision because they didn't do the planning in advance.
You're absolutely right, John. It's people are not wanting to address those issues or not wanting to even think about the process of getting older and losing capacity. Those are often difficult subjects and difficult conversations, but it doesn't have to be a crisis, and that's where I like to educate people and tell them there are other options. You don't have to be in a crisis mode. You can avoid these having a crisis by just simply having the correct documentation in place or by having those discussions ahead of time. So you're right on target there, John.
So and some of the things that cause this, because none of us expect to be in an accident, whether it's an auto accident or as a pedestrian or riding a bike or whatever, getting hit by a golf ball. You don't expect an accident that incapacitates you. But the other thing is those weird, maybe not so weird, but unexpected things like strokes that take away your ability to make the decisions that you would have made had you been healthy.
Yes. And oftentimes people think, oh, well, I have a spouse. They automatically have that power, and that is not accurate. So, and in particular, if you have certain family members who there's a disagreement over whom will be making decisions, you could have avoided that huge mess, basically, by just having well-drafted powers of attorney in place.
Just in case.
Yep, in case, at any age. I mean, I would say yes, in particular, when you're a senior or because dementia, Alzheimer's, those kinds of things are more likely. However, you just never know.
Right.
You just never know. And it's very simple, not very expensive, and not time consuming to get those documents prepared ahead of time. It's essential is what I tell people.
So what brought you to elder law?
I've always had a passion of working with seniors. I find it very meaningful, rewarding, and I really enjoy spending time listening to their stories. They all often have just such interesting histories, and I've found that just sitting down and just listening to them, they're always very appreciative. And I typically always learn something as well. But it just seems, it's always been a passion of mine, helping seniors. I've always been really close with my grandparents growing up and had really, really wonderful, close relationships with them. And I think that's probably where it started.
I find that those of us, because those of us who work in the senior community, we have a common interest in helping people and stuff. But all of us, we're exposed to so many wonderful stories. We could write books about, you know, it always reminds me after I visit with somebody, chicken soup for the soul. You know, you hear all these wonderful stories, but we hear them on a daily basis.
Mm-hmm. We do. Yeah. We do. And fascinating. I always learn something new, something I wasn't aware of, or different perspective. Different generations have different, you know, things to share. Always so appreciative. I think in our culture, we oftentimes don't listen necessarily, or we're not very good at listening to our seniors. And so I make a real effort to make sure that at least they feel like their voices are heard.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's really important.
So we have a certain percentage of the population that are planners and a certain percentage of the population that are procrastinators. So you also probably deal with people who are planners that put their plan together 20, 30 years ago. And maybe things have changed in their life. And so when's an appropriate time for people who were planners to take another look at their situation and just make sure everything's up to date?
I usually recommend that people at least have their estate planning documents reviewed every 10 years, because the laws can change, your goals can change, the family dynamics can change pretty quickly. So at least every 10 years, just to have a review. Now, that doesn't mean they need to all be changed or that any of the documents need to be changed, but it's just a good idea, a good rule of thumb to have them reviewed.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So when you sit down with a couple or an individual who are nearing retirement or maybe already retired, are there specific documents that you recommend to them, specific plans that you recommend?
Yes, and it depends on their particular situation, where they own real property, if it's outside of Washington State, for example, what their goals are. Not everyone has the same goals. So we've got to take all of those things into consideration in recommending a plan. But I will say that the essentials are power of attorney for medical care, power of attorney for finances, a health care directive, or what's also called a living will. Those are extremely important to have in place. And then if they're married, sometimes we do a community property agreement. And authorizations. We want to have an authorization, a HIPAA authorization, and an authorization for my office to work with whomever they've designated as power of attorney. So those are the essential bare minimum documents. And then we also talk about whether or not a will or a trust would be appropriate for that particular individual or family. And that takes into consideration how their assets are held, where they own their assets, what their goals are, and the family dynamics as well.
And I can see how the situation is the boss, because some families are, you know, they've been together for 50 plus years. Some families are blended families. Some people have adult dependents that they're caring for, special needs children or whatever?
A lot to take into consideration. So there isn't one cookie cutter, you know, approach to this. You're absolutely correct. We have to determine whether minor children, adult children with special needs, is this estate plan likely to be contested? All of those things are very important.
Is that common? Contested estate plans? Is that?
Well, I try to draft my estate planning documents in such a way that there's little likelihood for contesting, because of course no one wants to see their estate dwindle by just a bunch of family members fighting over the estate. So we really try to take those things into consideration. If there's a high likelihood that there's going to be some contesting, then we want to maybe recommend a trust where there's less likelihood of the ability to contest, or those kinds of situations.
So another big topic for seniors would be, and this is something that you just see, I see over and over, I'm sure you do, where you have a husband and wife been together, whether it's a few years or decades, one of them becomes ill, and many of the assets are used to care for that ill or injured spouse, because you don't want to see them suffer, you want to give them the best care possible, but then you have the potential of draining so many of those assets that the surviving spouse is now living a much lower standard of living. Mm-hmm. How do you address that issue? And not only how do you address it, but is that a topic you bring up when you're doing planning with folks?
Absolutely. I always try to take that opportunity to educate people that there are opportunities or ways to preserve your estate and not go broke paying for someone's care. There's two different scenarios, really. There's the married couple, and then there's a single person. There are two government programs available to help pay for care, and that is Medicaid and a veterans benefit called Aid in Attendance. And those are the two government benefits that we emphasize in my office to help people with that whole process. Medicaid is a welfare program, a means-tested benefit, whereby you have to have your resources and income underneath a certain threshold. However, there are strategies that you can implement to still preserve your estate and be above that threshold and still qualify for Medicaid. Similar types of strategies for the VA benefit as well. The VA benefit is up to $2,200 a month approximately. That's tax-free, and it's cash directly into the veteran's bank account or the surviving spouse's bank account. So that can be a really useful tool as well to really increase everyone's quality of life as they go through this process. So we've got an ill spouse in the facility. We're able to get that veteran's benefits, for example, to help offset the cost of care and really preserve part of the estate for that well spouse who's maybe still living at home. So that's really important to make sure that the well spouse doesn't go broke paying for care, and that VA benefit is one way to help with that piece. We can also look at a single person having to go into a facility. I don't want to see that person have to spend their entire estate down, then go on Medicaid and be destitute. What I'd like to see is us able to preserve some of the cash or resources that they have, go on Medicaid and have some resources available to them. Medicaid only allows seniors to have about $60 a month from their income, and frankly that barely pays for a haircut anymore. So what our goal is to preserve some cash for that senior who's in the facility so that they have some resources to pay for maybe going out for dinner with a family member for their birthday, whatever that may be, an extra set of dentures because they've lost theirs. That's important to have something available for them.
So when you're talking about in the facility, are people able to qualify for the Medicaid like you were talking about and still have in-home care?
Yes, absolutely. And the veterans benefit too.
So it doesn't have to be a situation where they're going on Medicaid and they're forced to live in a nursing home or something like that, because most people, given the choice, they live at home as long as they can safely live at home, and then at some point some people transition into assisted living or long-term living, and for them, that's the right move at that time.
So I see it go both ways, but yes, just to clarify, Medicaid will pay for some in-home care. The VA benefit is available for in-home care as well.
Okay.
So when I say, so we help people pay for what we call long-term care, which is in-home care, adult family home, assisted living, or the highest level of care, which is nursing home care.
Okay.
So that's how we help people pay for that with those two government programs, Medicaid and the VA aid in attendance benefit. I always make sure to ask what each particular individual's goal is, because it is never safe to assume. For example, I've got currently about an 85-year-old senior client. I asked her, do you want to stay at home? Absolutely not. She's feeling very isolated. She wants to go into a facility. She wants to play bingo. She wants to eat meals with other people. She does not want to be home. Mm-hmm. But that is not, some people do want to stay home for as long as possible. It really is particular to each individual. And we help people accomplish those goals. I certainly would not ever want to put someone into a facility, help them pay for care, if that's not where they want to be.
Right. Yeah. But you know, that isolation, it's unique that she recognizes that, because what I've found over the years with clients is some of the people that they're most resistant to leave home, and they had to only because it was safer for them to live somewhere else. Mm-hmm. Once they've embraced it, they absolutely love it. They love the camaraderie and the people that they get to know, and it's almost like another family for them.
Yes, I agree. Yep, I have lots of clients who may be very hesitant or not want to go into a facility, but it ends up being a very good thing.
They have fun.
Yeah.
They really do.
They do. And I will say, I think part of the tipping point there is when the senior is no longer able to drive.
Safety, yeah. Oh, so, I see. And loss of independence, sure.
They've lost their independence, and so that really has been kind of the tipping point, as far as I can see. When they can't drive any longer, they're not able to go to church anymore, to go to the grocery store, to really interact with people, and that's when things start to change.
Yeah. So the veterans benefits, are we talking only retired veterans that have done 20 plus years in the military, or how does that work?
Good question, John. So it is 90 days of consecutive active duty. One day has to have been during a period of war, not at war, but during a period of war. And the discharge had to have been not dishonorable, other than dishonorable. And then there's also, similar to Medicaid, an income and asset requirement, as well as a medical need, of course. But those thresholds are, we can get them even above those thresholds and still get them qualified for that veterans benefit. So usually, veterans have qualified for that, and veterans of this era have qualified for those 90 days, one day during a period of war. That usually is not a problem.
So it's not just Vietnam-era veterans or World War II veterans, it's people, like I was in the military from 80 to 86, and I never thought of myself as being at a time of war, but apparently our country, during that period of time, there were some conflicts that qualify, I guess. I had no idea until recently.
Yeah, it's a great benefit, complex to apply for, very complex to actually get approved by the VA, because they make it a little bit challenging, of course. But yes, you would likely qualify. However, because you don't have high medical needs, you wouldn't qualify yet.
Sure, yeah. And I hope I never do. But it's just interesting to know that it's not, you know, I have always thought of wartime veterans as World War II, Vietnam, you know, that kind of thing. But it's not. It's many people. Well, of course, the newer generation has, we've been in a conflict or a war for many, many years.
Yep.
So when we come across clients, and for this, they don't necessarily have to be over 65, correct?
If I can prove that they have a medical need, we can get them under 65, yes.
Right. Mm-hmm. Okay. So are we looking at veterans with medical needs and lower income? Because does the income matter?
It does, but that's typically the easy part for me.
Okay.
To get them qualified income-wise, yes.
Okay.
So they don't have to be low income, absolutely not.
Okay. So as I look at some of the folks that I meet or people who listen to this or read about this, what would be the trigger point for them to contact you and say, hey, I'd like to get more information and learn about do I qualify?
If they meet that initial threshold, the 90 consecutive days of active duty, one day during a period of war, and they had a discharge that was honorable, then, and if they have high medical expenses, which typically would be in-home care or in a facility.
So disabling medical expenses, or no, that's what I'm kind of wondering. Is it just like I know people who have terrible medical expenses, but they're still working. You know, maybe they're diabetic and you know different things, or you have other people who have actual disabling medical conditions where they're not able to work.
Yes, they're not working typically. They're
gotcha.
Either if they're under age 65, they're disabled and they've got extremely high medical expenses, or they're over the age of 65, not working, and they're receiving some in-home care or need in-home care or are in a facility or need to go into a facility, then those that would be the those are the target people that we could help.
Okay. Okay. And then, of course, like we said, anyone that wants more control later in their life should do some pre-planning ahead and not wait until it's an urgent situation. Because once it's an urgent situation, if I put myself in those shoes, once it's urgent, I may not have control over the decisions being made anymore if I haven't planned in advance.
Correct.
Now I have to rely on somebody else to make decisions for me, about me, when they're under the most extreme pressure they've probably been in their life.
Yes, and so that's, again, if you fail to have your powers of attorney in place, then a guardianship has to be filed and the judge will make the decision on who's going to make your medical and financial decisions. And sometimes that could be someone you don't even know.
Especially if you're single, you're not married. It could be one of your children that maybe you don't have the most confidence in their decision making.
Absolutely. Or I've seen many times we've got a blended family. We've got children from a prior marriage. We've got a new spouse. And it ends up being a huge fight between the whole family. And we end up going to trial. And while we're waiting to go to trial, there's no one designated to be making those decisions. There could be an unreasonable delay in healthcare decisions, all kinds of problems. And litigation like that is very expensive and very time consuming. And it can just all be avoided by having well-drafted powers of attorney in place. The same with a will or a trust. I don't know about you, but I want to make sure that I'm the person deciding how my estate is distributed. I would much rather, I don't want my estate being distributed by a judge making that decision by state statute. I want to determine that. I have minor children as well. I want to be the person deciding who will be the guardians of my minor children if something were to happen to my husband and I. I don't want the state to be making that decision. CPS, if I don't have a guardian, or if I don't have a guardian listed for my children, CPS will likely take the children and will find placement for them, whether it be with family members or non-family members. And if our family members are fighting over it, who will have guardianship over my minor children, that will be, that's just unnecessary, and I don't want that to happen. Most mm-hmm. people don't.
And that creates lifelong conflict for those family members, right?
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So what is the process? And I know we can't cover every single scenario, but just imagine the traditional nuclear family. They've been married 40, 50 years. One set of children, no will.
Mm-hmm.
Is it a different process if it's a married couple that loses a spouse versus it's a single person who's already lost their spouse, but now I've got a widow or widower who passes away without a will?
Well, there's a... So no will married couple. It depends on how the assets are held. If they're community-owned assets with what we call joint tenancy with right of survivorship, some of those assets will automatically go to the surviving spouse. So there's different ways to hold assets. You can hold assets as a married person as your separate property, meaning it's not part of the marital community, or you can hold assets as a joint tenancy with right of survivorship, or what we also call community property. So it really depends on how those are titled, but if you die without a will or without a trust or some kind of estate plan, then typically a judge needs to determine how your estate will be distributed by reading the local state statute and by following how the statute says your estate will be distributed. So it is different for a married couple versus a single person, because the determining factor sometimes for a married couple is how the assets are held.
Okay.
And it does have to go through what's called the probate process. If you have no estate planning documents and you're married, the probate process is the process whereby a judge determines how your estate is distributed. So there's court oversight, and typically an attorney is involved, and it's a minimum of a 4-month process.
Okay. That's another big, I guess, reason for someone to say, let's do some pre-planning so that our family doesn't have to go through that process.
Absolutely.
So a single individual, same thing, right? Only now, because it's a single individual, either with or without children, again, you have somebody else making a decision that may not be the equitable decision that you would have made, because of maybe it's someone estranged in your family, or one person's providing much more care and companionship for you versus another, and yet they're going to be treated differently than how maybe you would have treated them. The law is going to treat them differently, correct?
Exactly, correct. And you've got a judge sitting up on the bench who doesn't know you, doesn't know your goals, doesn't know the family dynamics, and they're making these decisions that could potentially will have a huge impact on you, your family, your estate. And frankly, that situation can easily be avoided by just setting up your estate plan ahead of time, making sure that your wishes are clear, and that you've expressed what your desires are and goals.
So a lot of people are intimidated by what the costs are going to be, but can't people do these? Let's say that they come in and they talk to you and you give them this big overview of some of the strategies that they should consider. They don't necessarily have to do this whole plan all at once, right? They can do it in stages and start with some of the basic powers of attorney and things like that, and then add, is that
absolutely
correct?
Sure. So we've got your essential estate planning documents, the basics, and then depending on every individual or family circumstances, then we may recommend some other documents. And those don't have to be done right away, but there's kind of the essentials that I like to see done for everyone. And then if we're going to do, for example, long-term care planning, that would be in addition. We know someone's going to need long-term care. They have, for example, early onset Alzheimer's, so we know we need to do some of that planning. We'll start with the estate planning documents, get those pieces in place, and then start at least the conversation of what the long-term care planning looks like, what we can do to help, and just start that conversation, really.
Okay. So we've covered kind of a broad range of topics in a relatively short period of time. Is there something that, because I don't have the experience that you have, is there something that I should have asked you about that I haven't? Is there something on top of your mind you're like, oh, I want to mention this?
Well, I will say that I often get people into my office and they say, well, there's nothing I can do. I have to spend down all of my estate in order to qualify for Medicaid or that veteran's benefit. So I'm going to go broke, and thank you very much, but I understand you can't help me because of everything I've read. And that is absolutely incorrect. There are many ways that we can strategize to get people qualified for Medicaid and that veterans benefit without having to spend down all of their assets.
Without having to feel like they're living in poverty.
Yes, correct.
And that's the key point. I think so many people have this image of being on Medicaid that you're going to spend the rest of your life living in poverty.
And that doesn't have to happen. So I just like to take the opportunity to educate people and let them know there's lots of things we can do. The worst scenario is when I get a senior into my office and for example, she says, oh, I've spent everything on my husband's care. He's in a nursing home. I've sold my home. What can you do to help? I've spent everything. That is the worst case scenario because they're coming to me too late. And I want people to know ahead of time there's things we can do to prevent that from happening. So don't believe everything you read on the internet. We can prevent that from happening. And it's important. We've got the well spouse potentially still at home. I don't want to see that person go broke paying for care. Mm-hmm. It doesn't need to happen. It shouldn't happen.
And it's not just in elder care. It is in almost every aspect of our life as we get older. Planning in advance saves so much anxiety and heartache. It actually gives you peace of mind. But if we could just convince people, don't put off what you, in the back of their mind, I think everybody knows, I should do this, I should do that. But that procrastination creeps in, or that discomfort of talking about things that we're uncomfortable with, and it put it off. And I can't tell you how many times I've heard this over the few decades that I've been working with seniors. That exact scenario where somebody has spent so much of the assets caring for the ill spouse, and now because they've waited so long, their future is way different than it could have been.
Yes, you're absolutely correct, John. And I would also point out saving time, stress, burden, but also saving money, honestly, by paying the money ahead of time to have a plan in place for long-term care, for your estate plan, whatever that looks like. You save much more money on the back end by not having to go through probate, for example, or by having a plan in place on how to pay for long-term care. Having a plan ahead of time actually saves money.
And you're not, when you say planning for long-term care, you're not just talking about long-term care insurance. That's a portion for those who are healthy enough to get it and can afford it. That's a wonderful thing
Correct.
To have. But many, many people get to this stage and their health, they don't qualify for long-term care insurance, or maybe they do, but they just don't have the resources to spend what it takes for that. It's great for the people who can do it. So when you're talking about long-term care planning, that's different from long-term care insurance.
Yes, okay. It is.
That's what I wanted to clarify that, because some people hearing this might think, oh, I've already looked into long-term care insurance, but that's not what you're talking about.
No, I'm talking about preserving your estate and pursuing the two government benefits available, Medicaid and the veterans benefit.
Okay, wonderful. All right, so Holland, thank you very, very much for spending this time with me. I hope we get to do this again, because as time goes by, things change. Like you said, laws change, and if it seems appropriate, we need to update people.
Well, thank you, John, for having me. I appreciate it.
All right.
This has been the Medicare Made Simple podcast. If you are planning to receive Medicare benefits now or in the future, follow us on iTunes or visit our website for more information at www.wespeakmedicarespokane.com.